You know, every time I speak, I want the truth to come out. You know what I'm saying? Every time I speak, I want to shiver. You know, I don't want them to be like, they know what I'm going to say because it's polite. They know what I'm going to say. And even if I get in trouble, you know what I'm saying? That ain't that what we're supposed to do? I'm not saying I'm going to rule the world or I'm going to change the world, but I guarantee that I will spark the brain that will change the world.
I think what you're trying to ask is, why am I so insistent upon giving out to them that blackness, that black power, that black pushing them to identify with black culture? I think that's what you're asking. I have no choice over it. In the first place, to me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the whole world, black people. I mean, and I mean that in every sense, outside and inside. And to me, we have a culture that is surpassed by no other civilization, but we don't know anything about it. So again, I think I've said this before in this same interview, I think at some time before, my job is to somehow make them curious enough or persuade them by hook or crook to get more aware of themselves and where they came from and what they are into and what is already there, and just to bring it out. This is what compels me to compel them. And I will do it by whatever means necessary.
I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, and welcome to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. We are the return of intelligent radio as we ensure the free flow of opinions and push the envelope on the questions America's afraid to ask in the mainstream media. Good morning to all the intellectual outcasts out there. This is considered a special edition show. Again, y'all know I go by the name Black Socrates, and I try to word our discussion questions or our dialogue in the form of a question. And today, as you see, today's topic, to let the cat out of the bag, is my book. I just released it officially last night at the Mental Dialogue Live Experience. Let me shout out all those that came out last night and damn near sold me out. So I definitely appreciate those in the Atlanta area that was able to celebrate with us at Urban Grind. But today's show, Re-Education of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture, is the title of my book. It is available on Amazon. But we're going to share some commentaries with a couple of special returning guests, two of the smartest brothers I know. I wanted to have a deep dive into the book, as I will introduce them and explain to everyone out there exactly how to experience the book. It's not a book that you simply read. It's a book that you experience. But without further ado, I'm going to start with my brother, Ebel Bryant. Thank you, King, for being black with us once again. If you will, say hello to the intellectual outcast before I introduce you to our other brother that we all know so well, Edward Hopkins. But go ahead, brother. Let people know a little bit about yourself before we introduce Ed.
Peace, kings and queens, brothers and sisters. I appreciate y'all. Montoya came to me with this book and read me some excerpts, and I was hyped. And the reason why is because we need to talk. And so today, it's all about getting that discussion flowing and going. So my job is, as an author, is to tell stories and to see what I see right in front of me and then say what I see. That's been the hardest thing for me, is to just keep seeing what's right in front of me. And so with this book, we're going to talk about what's right in front of us.
Now, I love it. And again, without further ado, this brother has been making time for me. He's one of the busiest brothers I know, but he's definitely the most well-read brother I know. So I'm super excited to have none other than Edward C. Hopkins, the second attorney. I know you have your thing in a couple states, but you tell people about yourself. But thank you once again, King, for being with us again just recently. But thank you for making more time for us.
Well, thank you, my good brother, for having me. Thank you for allowing me to share this time with everyone in your community that you've built. It's an amazing community. I'm an attorney. I am also an entrepreneur, and I'm also an investor. But like our good brother Smitty has said, I read quite a bit, and I actually enjoy it. So thank you for having me, and I look forward to today's conversation.
No, absolutely. And so what I'm going to share for the audience, if you're just now finding out, hopefully you've seen the promotions, but if you are a new listener, I'm going to read how to read my book, which is, this is the back of the book. And this really will set the precedent for what you're about to hear today, which is me sharing some of the commentaries. The book is a bunch of commentaries in order to invoke these type of discussions, as you will hear from the description of how to read the book. And so the first, again, this is the back of the book. Go purchase it on Amazon. If you're in Atlanta, meet me live and I'll definitely give it to you. It says, this book is designed for re-education and mental dialogue at family gatherings, dinner parties, roundtables, and events. The commentary should not be read simply for agreement. The various perspectives are shared to push the envelope on long-held thoughts and beliefs. Unfortunately, our society has learned to cancel ideas we disagree with versus critically thinking about them. Let's genuinely listen to explore the nuance of opposing views for their merit. The objective is to learn, not to reject ideas simply because they trigger your cognitive dissonance. Hence, the best way to digest this book is to share the commentaries that resonate with you most, to see what others think, especially the ones you disagree with. The commentaries may not always offer a complete thought. They are intentionally left open-ended to present provoking dialogue with others. Ultimately, the goal is to select your favorite and or your most reviled commentaries to discuss with others, because this book is designed for necessary conversation. Emil, I'll start with you just real brief, because as you said, as an author, I love how you said that you want to see what's in, I mean, you, matter of fact, I'll let you say it again. But as you said, mentioned, these are conversations we need to have. And again, thank you for prepping me for last night's event. That went wonderful. But again, just a quick thought on hearing how to read the book, and then I'm going to share a commentary to start us off, and we'll go to break.
I have done the same thing for my work that you've done for yours. I have a workbook where I said how to use this workbook. And the problem that people have is that they've been trained to do something without thinking. And the way we're trained occludes our vision. So what I said was, can I see what's right in front of me? And then talk about what's right in front of me. Because the way we're trained in our society often makes us blind to things that would otherwise be right in front of our face. And your book and how you're asking us to read it is going to change the paradigm. It's going to force us out of our rote use of our knowledge. We can't simply go back to memory and say, start at the beginning, go to the end. We have to go inside, pull out what's valuable or what's challenging, or what makes us feel uncomfortable, and talk about it with people who might challenge our paradigm and force us to see things that are right in front of us.
No, absolutely. Thank you for that. So I'm going to share this very short piece, Ed. I'll get a thought from you, then we're going to go to break. This is that piece that I opened the event with last night to give a little context. We always have icebreakers at the live experience, and the icebreaker, I gave people various Black history figures, but I gave them difficult ones. Usually I'll give easy ones so they can guess them. And so they talk back and forth. I had them discuss Black history figures that they recall from their education in primary school education, other than MLK, Frederick Douglass, and Harriet Tubman. So they would introduce and say, hey, here's who I remember from when I was young. And then they would also try to guess. I give them a card of a Black history figure and say, can the other person guess it? So it's pretty cool. And so this piece was how I started the event last night. This piece is called Black Socrates Speaks, 20 Feet Tall. One of the best lessons you can give your children is to teach them to walk through the world as if they are 20 feet tall, because greatness is never stumbled upon, but rather blossoms out of supreme self-confidence due to the fact they've put in the work. Without confidence, very little can be accomplished. With it, damn near anything. One of the best ways to teach this lesson is to provide them real-life examples of greatness. Start here. Hashtag A.G. Gaston. Hashtag Herman J. Russell. Hashtag Robert Smith, billionaire. Hashtag Maggie Walker. Hashtag Earl Grey Seniors. Hashtag Mae Jemison. Hashtag Katherine Johnson, Hidden Figures. Hashtag Ella Baker, NAACP. Hashtag Misty Copeland. Hashtag Stephen Biko. Hashtag Patrice Lumumba. Any child who learns about these hashtags will surely grow to 20 feet tall. Just my 3 cents. All I ask is this, that you think. Ed, just a quick thought on that introduction for a book called The Reeducation of the Negro.
That's excellent. That's an excellent introduction, and I'm very happy that you included some of our most preeminent entrepreneurs in that list. Those are black figures that we don't, I think, speak enough about, particularly folks like A.G. Gaston. But I tell you, Brother Frederick Douglass would have been proud of that, so I am also proud of it.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to a short break, and we're going to start sharing commentaries. We'll give out the number for people that want to join in discussion because, again, these commentaries are set for dialogue. Y'all can join us as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Do you simply want your taxes done this tax season, or do you prefer to have your taxes completed by a professional on top of current and constantly changing tax codes? If so, look no further than S. Kynes Accounting and Tax Services, where each year, plenty of satisfied customers from around the country return for an efficient and professional tax experience. For small businesses, S. Kynes Accounting and Tax not only provides bookkeeping and accounting on a monthly, quarterly, and or yearly basis, but S. Kynes Accounting and Tax goes above and beyond to provide yearly tax strategies to increase the bottom line, profits. While no one likes when Uncle Sam or the IRS comes knocking, know you're in good hands with S. Kynes Accounting and Tax. Call them today at 770-947-3667. Again, that's 770-947-3667, or email them at advice@thetaxcoach.com.
S. Kynes Accounting and Tax, amazing reviews. Glad to have them as a sponsor. They do virtual taxes as well, so this is a not only a nationwide show, but anywhere around, you know, it is international as well, but anywhere around the country, you can actually reach out to them, let them know you heard about the commercial here on Mental Dialogue, and you will get $50 off your taxes as well as your taxes done by a tax professional who keeps up with the latest updates. So keep that in mind. Definitely check them out. This morning's discussion question, though, I'm so used to saying discussion question, today is featuring my book. The title of today's show is Reeducation of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture. With special guests are Emil Bryant, as well as attorney Edward Hopkins. Going to start with this commentary. Matter of fact, let me give the number out, too, because I see some callers out there if y'all want to join us. The number is 646-787-1691, and you, too, can have dialogue with us on these commentaries. The first one that I'm going to share, well, technically the second one, Black Socrates Speaks, God Bless America. And I'll start out with a couple of stats, and then I'll start the commentary. It says, out of 60 million yearly police citizen encounters, the police shoot approximately 900 to 1,000 suspects yearly, of which about 20 to 40 are unarmed black citizens. It took 240 years to be recognized as humans and 50 more years to be recognized as citizens, but we still live with America's blatant disregard for black life. The epitome of being black in America is being told sorry by the defense attorney who forgot you were still in the courtroom, all the while showing the video footage of the attempts to revive your black son's life after being shot by the defendant, an off-duty cop who mistakenly thought he was a burglar in his own apartment. R.I.P. Botham John. Black lives don't matter. And yet to express anything but an undying love for America, and you will promptly be told to leave the country by those not burdened by this blatant disregard. They act as if black people should be grateful to no longer be enslaved, and these modern-day lynchings, a.k.a. police murders, are nowhere near as frequent as lynchings were in this country from 1895 to 1925. In other words, stay in your place, shut the fuck up, and God bless America. Just my 3 cents. All I ask is that you think. Reactions, brother. Either one of you can jump in.
Well, you know, brother, in my library shelves, I have a couple of books about the history of lynching in America, including Sharon Ifill's On the Courthouse Lawn and Terry Ann Scott's Lynching and Leisure. Reading those books really is a horrifying experience, but it is also an important one to endure. Because what you learn is that the real motive behind the lynching was terror. And the reason why terror was the motive is because the European Americans who so utterly dominated the Africans that were brought to America wanted to make sure they lived in fear. They wanted to make sure that they knew that, that if they ever attempted to exert any type of free will, any type of attempt at living a normal life, that they would be slapped down, that they would be beat down, and they would be murdered. They also wanted them to know that they had no rights, they were not human, and that their only chance of making it to another day was to submit to the will of their oppressors and their enslavers. I can tell you, brother, that I see what is happening to our young black men and sometimes our older black men now as very much the same thing. It's a terrorist activity. And although the media will not want to frame it that way, I don't know how else any reasonable person could see it. When I go outside, I am more mindful, I am more mindful of my surroundings than an equally educated, similarly situated white man. And the reason why is because I know that there are realistic reasons for me to be concerned about my safety, even though I will do nothing wrong when I leave my home. The mere fact that I have to take that into consideration as a result of centuries of successful terrorism in the United States, though it has become more subtle and oftentimes a little more difficult to see, it is still a form of terrorism to me, and that's how I see it. So those are my entry thoughts into the conversation.
Absolutely. Amir, any thoughts? Then I'm gonna have you guys tackle the questions for this particular commentary. Any thoughts from you real quick before I ask the first question?
Absolutely. So Brother Malcolm X said there's no such thing as a second-class citizen. The Red Summer of 1919 proved that black men could go off to fight war on behalf of this nation and support its version of democracy and come home and receive none of that which they defended. That problem persists throughout the centuries, that we have been willing to sacrifice blood, time, and treasure on behalf of a nation that is not only ungrateful, but hostile to our presence once we return from those engagements. It happens after every major war when we get a taste of what life could be like without the unique, peculiar, institution-driven form of American racism. So when we talk about these lynchings, whether they're ancient or modern, the difference is not just numerical. In fact, it was a lynching per week for almost 70 years on average in America. For a period of about 70 years. But today, we're seeing one murder happen over and over again, perpetuated through social media, perpetuated through mainstream media, perpetuated through press accounts, courtroom accounts, re-traumatizing our people over and over again who watch that, who listen to it, who hear, and then seeing the lack of justice from that. So it's not just the act itself, but in the modern era, with the advent of social media and mainstream media being so ubiquitous, it's also the repeat nature of it over and over again, drilling into it over and over again. And that is just as much a part of the sanctioned terrorism as it was when it was happening once per week.
Thank you for your thoughts. Actually, somebody wants to jump in, so I'll let them jump in before I ask the first question. Area code 609, last 3891. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents on this morning's dialogue.
Good morning, Montel. This is Marilyn calling. I'm so
it's
excited
Montoya,
about
man.
Your book.
Montoya. Thank you so much, Queen. Go ahead.
I'm excited about your book. We do need to be re-educated. We do need to be self-taught and not plantation taught. And I'm just going to bring this to the forefront. DeSantis yesterday down in Florida wants to disband all black fraternities and sororities. He didn't say anything about the white ones. He specifically said the black ones. So the clock is turning back on us. And if we don't not just be woke but wake up, we're going to be back where we were, back where we've been struggling to come from. I can't wait to read your book. But we have got to start, as the gentleman said, start regurgitating what we're taught, because the plantations are the ones that are teaching us in the schools and in the secondary education system. You know, so I'm getting an honorary degree. And somebody told me that that wasn't a real degree because I didn't spend 4 years in school. I said, you're right. I said, God gave me the shortcut. I didn't spend 4 years in school being taught by a racist system, and I didn't give them thousands and thousands of dollars to do it. Okay, so we have got to change the narrative on the way we see, speak, and understand this world and how it relates to us. And we have to realize we are a nation inside of a nation inside of a nation. And we've got to come together and do that. We have got to start buying black art by black citizens. We have got to start reading books and collecting books with our history in it. We are trying to ban and erase everything we have come to know about ourselves. And we have really got to buckle down. We've got to start voting and getting involved in the political system. We've got to learn politics. We've got to learn who's running. We have to groom our own candidates and stop saying, well, I'm not going to vote because it's this and it's that. A vote that you don't cast for someone who's on our team is a vote for the other team. Okay? At the last minute, you can't say, I want to do a write-in vote. You have to play this thing out. You have to vote in every election from the dog catcher, from the schoolhouse to the White House. Every single election that you are eligible to vote in, you have to cast your vote.
But I'm not going to let you tell people to vote for Maryland, just so you know. You know, we always had that argument.
About what? About voting?
Yeah, I said, but I'm not going to let you tell me who to vote for. I'm messing with you a little bit because we went back and forth about this issue a couple of times. So I'm just kind of highlighting
it. No, I'm not going, but it's, you have to be in the system, and it's not a matter of who to vote for. It's like, why are you voting for them? You know,
Yeah, of course we'll have that dialogue. I'm not a fan of you have to vote, but having to vote means one way. So I'm just kind of throwing that out, just messing with you a little bit.
No. I'm not saying that,
I'm just messing with you a little bit, Queen. I'm just messing with you. I absolutely appreciate that. Appreciate your thoughts. Definitely grab the book, and I hope it creates some dialogue for you with your family as well. I want to get through a couple of these questions before we get to our next break, but thank you so much for supporting. And actually, think about becoming a member. You've been a long-time listener, so think about that, if you will, Queen. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay, I was there, and I was just saying thank you for your three sisters morning. I said if you will consider becoming a member. You've been listening for a long time, so definitely support what we're doing.
I will.
All right, thanks a lot, Queen. So I wanted to get a couple of these questions in before we get to our next break. Anybody else that wants to join us, you do have to press 1 so you can be like Marilyn and get on the show. The first question I'll ask, and this is, I'll just help Ed, you address this because I know you're familiar with this decorum. It's just really a simple question. It's not even that deep of a thought, but it's just because I know most people are not aware of this decorum, I just highlighted the question just to bring it to their attention. And it says, can you imagine the trauma of Bathmajan's parents watching the footage of their son dying after the attorney forgot to ask them to leave the courtroom before showing it to the jury? And I put in parentheses, common courtesy. That I don't let much get to me, Ed, but when I found out that happened in that courtroom, and just being a legal studies major, never having went on to law school like you did, but just being familiar with the decorum, that's one thing that actually bothered me a lot. So just wanted to hear your thoughts on that one real quick before we go to question number 2.
Well, one, you can't imagine it. Unless you have actually experienced it. You can attempt the best you can to try to empathize by comparing such a horrific scene to some of the worst days and moments of your life, but you cannot understand until or unless you are in that person's shoes and you feel that, what those parents felt. When that happened, it wasn't so much a huge in terms of legal proceeding. It was more of an error of, how can I put it, compassion.
Absolutely.
At the point when they did that, they had no reason to believe that the parents watching that video would do anything other than destroy them. And they should have taken much greater care to ease them into the horrific scene than they did. So it wasn't so much of a legal error, but
right,
it was a discompassionate way to go through the proceeding. And we all wish it hadn't been done that way.
No, absolutely. And what I highlight is that is what I consider not the ignorance of not knowing, and it's just a natural compassion that I would assume would have, people would have. But when you're indifferent to someone because of how they look, that's how that, and again, you're right. That's why I call it the decorum. It's common courtesy, as you said, not legally required, but it is common courtesy to ask in that situation to dismiss the parents, to show whatever they think they need to show for the jury to make their decision or not make the decision. So it's understood that it was necessary evidence, but it is definitely decorum and courtesy. And I pointed out as an indifference that I find despicable. All right, let's go to question number two, and I'll start with you, Emil. During the height of the lynching period, as you just mentioned, a black person was hung actually daily in this country for 25 to 30 years straight. Today, can you imagine seeing police shootings daily on the news? And let me say this real quick, just to give you some context. I'm actually putting on his head that as much as we see these things on social media, I don't know if we're aware of this, but we don't see them daily. And I'm intentionally highlighting there is a difference compared to what our ancestors horrifically went through daily, a daily lynching. And so when you talked about the redundancy of seeing it on social media, that is not the same as seeing it happen daily. And I wanted to push the envelope on the context for even us to recognize today that we don't see this daily, and it doesn't happen daily as much as it happened to our ancestors in reality under much harsher circumstances. It's a question to wake us up to that difference, because I think we too often say things are still the same, and I'm challenging that context. Your thoughts, King?
So you are 100% correct. My grandfather was 9 years old during the Red Summer of 1919. He heard the chatter that other men were talking about when a lynching happened. There's a difference between what we see on social media as a repeat of the George Floyds and the Botham Jeans and others, and having the visceral experience of hearing grown men whisper, often in fear, about what's happening in their neighborhood. All right, my grandfather was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, so the Red Summer of 1919 was a very visceral point in his childhood. So I can't imagine how he felt, but I can understand that it was a regular occurrence that he heard these whispers, that he saw the concern on his father's and his father's friends and uncle's faces. He understood the powerlessness felt because they couldn't defend themselves as robustly as they thought they should or could, given the circumstances. That is not the same as this. And a lot of times when I hear people say things haven't changed, I wish they would go back to a time. Again, I'm a storyteller as a writer. I go back to the time and put themselves in the shoes of people who don't have social media, don't have radio and TV, but do have the very concerned voices of each other in a community where words spread like wildfire. It's a different form of communication, and it's no less impactful. But the point is, now we're talking about somebody's brother. I'm not related to George Floyd in any context. I don't know him, and 99.999% of all black America doesn't really have a relationship with George Floyd other than we can identify. But in 1919, when my grandfather was a boy, there was a real relationship. They were neighbors. They were uncles. They were brothers. They were kinfolk. They were people down the street. They were people. They were the barber, the farmer, the brother who delivered milk. This is a completely different context. And that's something that we have to really wrestle with, is we're seeing people that we don't know personally, but then it was somebody's brother, somebody's uncle, somebody's barber, somebody's friend, somebody who had had dinner at your house, or you had had dinner and played with their children. That's a whole different ballgame. And that influenced how my grandfather grew up, and it translated to how he raised my parents and me. and eventually. So yeah, there's a vast difference, and sometimes we forget those visceral, emotional, real experiences of fathers and mothers having to deal with somebody they knew being dragged out of their home, dragged out of their business in front of a crowd of people and being powerless to do anything about it. That's a whole different ballgame than what we see today.
And I would love for us, we're up against the break, and we'll go to another commentary after the break. But I would just love for us to recognize, as you just mentioned, that closeness in relationship, actually witnessing it, possibly unfortunately, and just ultimately understand to a degree to simply say, because it is because of that traumatic, because all of that trauma and offense has been passed down generationally, is why we respond to and say the term, nothing has changed or is still the same. And I'm just highlighting that it's actually a disservice to our ancestors who actually went through that period to have us in a period where it's not happening daily. But again, recognizing trauma can seem real, so that's why we speak the same, but we should become aware of the difference so that we can not allow, as Ed opened the show with to a degree, allow that trauma to put us in a place of fear, in the same fear that they, as Ed pointed out, the terror that they were attempting to create. The dynamic is still there, but we should become very aware and be very grateful to our ancestors that we are in a much better place to, as Ed said, be aware of my surroundings, but they literally lived in fear because any day it could be a brother, it could be a cousin, or it could be a neighbor. We're up against the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Have you heard the adage that a picture is worth a thousand words? Well, meet Livy Blue Photography, a premier company specializing in capturing your family portraits and turning them into wall art that stands the test of time. One visit to their website, livyblue.com, and you will immediately be blown away by the experience as you peruse their gallery. The lead photographer, Jalivia Northern, is a published photographer with over 10 years of experience in capturing families, weddings, and school senior portraits. If you want a breathtaking photography experience, contact Livy Blue Photography at livyblue.com. That's LIVIBLUE.com.
Check out Livy Blue if you want to turn your family portraits into wall art. Amazing company. Definitely check them out at livyblue.com. This morning's special edition, Re-Education of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture. My special guests are Edward C. Hopkins and Emil Bryant. I'm going to read another commentary from the book. Again, the book is designed for you to have the same dialogues that we're doing now. Some of the commentaries have discussion questions. And so this next one is keeping us up-to-date version of what we were just talking about. And this one is entitled, Black Socrates Speaks, The Right to Remain Silent. In parentheses, it says, Black people stop denouncing violence. And this was written in 2016, right after Michael Johnson was blown up by Dallas police. Violence begets violence is a mantra accepted around the world. For some, the killing of the five officers in Dallas was, as Malcolm said upon hearing about President Kennedy's assassination in Dallas in 1963, the chickens coming home to roost. I'm not repeating Malcolm's words to insinuate justification for the attack on the police in Dallas. However, I will not continue to play this game from the playbook of white supremacy, which means as an African American, I now must utterly denounce the Dallas cop killings, the response, with more zest and vitriol than I denounced the cops killing, hashtag Alton Sterling, or hashtag Philando Castile, the original act of violence. I haven't heard a word from the National Rifle Association, which constantly argues that our Second Amendment rights should not be abbreviated in any manner for fear of what happened to Alton Sterling in a right to carry state. This begs the question, would I not be justified if I returned their silence considering these police shootings? Now, for anyone confused about what's happening to our country, I suggest you wake up and stop being confused. Every one of us, no matter race, creed, gender, or color, understands being fed up. Clearly, the shooter, Michael Xavier Johnson, was fed up. For some, Johnson will be considered a hero, although I would not call him that. I do, however, consider him braver than myself. Activist David Banner once said on the Rock Newman Show that the only two things white supremacy respects are violence and money. While I've already alluded to my fear of the first approach, like Martin Luther King, I don't find violence prudent either. For the past 2 days on social media, I've watched black women express their deepest concerns for our well-being as black men. There is the very real possibility that Johnson's ambush of these 12 cops just put the safety of all black men in America even more at risk. Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation comes out in theaters later this year and tells the story of Nat Turner. Still, a two-hour film cannot cover the aftermath of the rebellion, which included 100 to 200 additional murders and lynchings, well beyond the 56 accused participants lynched for their 48-hour rebellion. The other murders and slave codes that followed Turner's rebellion directly resulted from white supremacy's backlash. Could these police killings in Dallas again trigger the backlash of white supremacy? Absolutely. However, I do not stand in fear of white supremacy or its backlash. Therefore, you won't hear me denouncing the killing of the Dallas police officers before police shooting us down in the streets is addressed. If the police continue to murder us indiscriminately, take my silence however you wish. Just my 3 cents. All I ask is that you think. Quick sidebar says, some may find disgust in my sentiment about Johnson's bravery, but if you don't find equal disdain in George Zimmerman's selling the gun that shot Trayvon to enthusiastic buyers, then like Jesse Williams said on the BET Awards broadcast when he addressed police brutality, sit down. Reactions, either one, brother.
Well, I can tell you, brother, that this is it. You know, there's a book that I encourage anybody who has been misled to believe that the Africans who have lived here in the United States have been docile, have not fought back, have not tried to protect their own bodies and their households' bodies. For those of you who have been led to believe or misled to believe that we don't have a rich history of defending ourselves, oftentimes with weapons and with guns, absolutely, I encourage you to read Nicholas Johnson's book, 2014 book, Negroes and the Gun. The subtitle is A Black Tradition of Arms. So we know guns. Black folks know guns. Indeed, that's one of the reasons why we have police in the United States, because blacks had guns, and we were ready to defend ourselves against domestic terrorism. Now, it is not called domestic terrorism in our history books, but that is what it was. When people would come for you and your family, wake you up in the middle of the night, burn crosses in front of your home, threaten to kill and rape your children, what are you going to do to prepare for that day, knowing that it is likely inevitable for you? So when you take it to the modern context and you see our young men, our brothers and sisters being slain by the police force that was created to keep black people in check in America, you aren't too far astray from reason when you think about whether we should be thinking differently than the media tries to make us think about how we are going to go about protecting our own. So when a man makes a decision to be offensive in what he believes is an ongoing war, we don't have to agree with him to understand why he did it. And that's something that everybody needs to be mindful of. You do not have to agree with what he did to understand why he did it, to empathize with the mentality that caused him to do it. We can do that, and we should feel safe discussing those types of things rather than feeling as though we have to hide our true beliefs about what happened from the public.
Absolutely, and that's why I wrote the piece, because I hate people kowtowing to the narrative to act like we need to denounce what he did to have a dialogue. No, have the dialogue in your truth. Let's go to one of these questions. The first question says, during his time, Martin Luther King never saw violence as prudent for African Americans since we were only 10% of the population. Do you agree or disagree? Your thoughts, Emil.
Violence is not prudent in a nation that has proven itself willing to use nuclear weapons to get its way. I'm not under any illusion that mass violence works, because the point of escalation, we as a people will never win. And based on my read of history, there's an unlimited capacity for violence in this nation. I go back to World War II with nuclear weapons. Coming forward, the policy of mutually assured destruction, I'm very confident that this nation, if it feels like it's threatened, and J. Edgar Hoover associated black freedom with an existential threat to American democracy. He made that connection, and every president since he became the director of the FBI has supported that notion that black freedom is equivalent to an existential threat to American democracy or America as a whole, or however you want to frame it. So for us to say that violence is prudent in the mass context, I think is a fool's game. It doesn't work, because there's the capacity for violence is nearly unlimited, proven over and over again within and outside of these borders. However, there are times when, very specifically, violence is probably the right response. And the Black Panthers proved that in Oakland specifically, but in other places besides, that we can have points at which violence is a necessary response to the violence against us in order to bring it down. But in mass, no way. It is just not going to work. And there's a small but very well-armed and very determined faction of people in this country who are anticipating war and have armed themselves appropriately. And unfortunately, they outnumber the people, black people, who are prepared for that same war. I'm not saying we won't have one. I'm saying as a mass strategy, violence is just going to create more death and fewer solutions than it would. But in points, specific places around the country, absolutely, it may be a necessary response.
Yeah, and I would always highlight the context that we mentioned before this break on the last piece is the not understanding when we say things have not changed or things are still the same. When you lay out exactly what happened to our ancestors, and to Ed's point, that book of Negroes and the Guns, there's so many examples where that pointed violence was absolutely necessary and absolutely successful. And so, again, I agree with you. There is a distinction between those two. But I would also highlight in today's context, sometimes when people highlight, in a sense, that's what should be done, they are pretty much not paying attention to the unlimited willingness of violence as a response and being outnumbered 4.5-1, which is what Martin Luther King talked about. And there's so much bravery in the approach he took because it wasn't prudent to be successful on the level that he was trying to be. I'll have you answer this second question, which is pretty much some of what we're saying now. If black people started violently responding to police interactions, would cops be more afraid to harm black people, or would they become more trigger happy, in your opinion?
It depends on how well trained the brothers doing the shooting work. So let me just explain what I... No. I did say that to add a little levity to it, but there's also some seriousness to it. So you'd be surprised by how good black men were with guns a couple of hundred years ago. You'd be surprised. They spent a lot of time perfecting their marksmanship. And there are a whole bunch of things that go into successfully defending your body in your household in a violent space, understanding tactics, understanding weapons, understanding how to maintain your weapons. All of this is part of a preparatory education. Now, in the United States, as Emil was talking about earlier, we have several militias. Our law enforcement agencies are well aware of them. They spend all day, all week training, getting ready for what they believe will one day be a war between races in the United States, or a war against a government that's going to come and try to take away what they consider to be their unfettered liberty. Those brothers were they to make that type of move and decide to exercise that strategy of actually being offensive towards the police force. If they were very well trained, very well organized, they would strike fear into the police, and most of the policemen who are considering retiring early would retire early, and you would have a lot more folks who would choose other professions. It would be much more difficult, I believe, to get people to go into the profession due to the increased danger that they would face. But on the contrary, if brothers just as a notion decided to go on the same day, buy a gun, and then go shoot police, they will not put fear into the police. They'll be undertrained, and the police won't fear people who don't know what they're doing. They will fear a real big surge in folks going out there as vigilantes, but if they're not well-trained, the police will feel confident that their training will allow them to prevail. So I see it both ways.
No, I love it. Thank you for that thought. We're up against the break. We'll be right back. For anybody out there listening, you can join us. I see some callers out there. If you're just listening, no problem. If you're trying to join, especially first-time callers, I hope you're listening closely. You do have to press 1 to let me know you want to jump in on this discussion. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Have you heard the adage that a picture is worth a thousand words? Well, meet Livy Blue Photography, a premier company specializing in capturing your family portraits and turning them into wall art that stands the test of time. One visit to their website, livyblue.com, and you will immediately be blown away by the experience as you peruse their gallery. The lead photographer, Jalivia Northern, is a published photographer with over 10 years of experience in capturing families, weddings, and school senior portraits. If you want a breathtaking photography experience, contact Livy Blue Photography at livyblue.com. That's LIVIBLUE.com.
Hey, are you a wine drinker?
A little bit here and there, but my wife definitely loves hers. Why you ask?
Man, you gotta try this vegan wine by Sip and Share Wine. I ran across them at this event in Atlanta, and now I keep me a few bottles at the house. What flavor you like?
I mean, I like me a good red or maybe a nice dipping deal or something. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, try this sweet red first.
Okay, that's nice and smooth right there. Yeah, that's kind of sweet like I like it. You know what I'm talking about?
For sure, that's why I like that one as well. Hey, now try this Conjure Zinfandel. This one was featured in Forbes magazine as a top 10 drink for the summer. See what you think.
Oh, okay. Now that's fire right there. Where can I get a bottle of that?
Just go to sipandsharewines.com. They'll ship it right to your door. They black on, too.
Oh, yeah? Okay, you said what? Sipandsharewines.com? Is that it?
Yep.
Bad.
Shout out to Sip and Share Wines. They actually brought my promo bottles of my signature wine I'm releasing, the Mental Dialogue Black Level MD Moscato Montoya Smith signature wine. I was able to share some of those with my members last night, so pretty cool. Actually, we got a caller that wants to jump in, so let me let the caller jump in before I read the next quick commentary from the book, Reeducation of the Negro. Area code 503, last 3862. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents on this morning's discussion.
Yes, my name is Edna White, and I live in Portland, Oregon. And I believe the author has some relatives in this city. And my question is, what are your thoughts on what's going on? I don't know. I imagine it's going on throughout the country, but here in Portland, we're having an epidemic of black-on-black crime among our young people, 20 and 30 years old. I'm an older woman, and so many of my young family members have gotten injured and killed because of one another. We just had a shooting at one of the big hotels here where individuals, as I heard their last names, I know their relatives, and drugs and crime are just fueling the attacks of young blacks, specifically men, on one another. I've walked down the streets and seen them jump out of their cars and arguing and fighting. And, oh, I tell you, I'm just encouraging our black men, specifically who are in the know, because I know it's a multiple pronged issue, the breakdown of the family, finances, and the drugs, and I mean there's just so many things. But it's like we've gone from fighting for rights as far as not getting beat up or killed by the police, but now our young people are injuring themselves. And so that's my thought and concern right now, the safety of our young people. And I've had 3 nephews who've been killed by violence, and they weren't part of a game, just, you know, getting shot. So just my thoughts right now.
No, absolutely. No, absolutely. Thank you for your 3 cents this morning, and I absolutely sympathize. I have to sympathize you losing especially several family members to the type of violence that you're pointing out. And I will highlight just a little context in reference and something that we've talked about plenty of times on this show. I will highlight humans by nature. There's a couple of conditions in which you will see that type of stuff increase. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, we've seen a 30% increase in gun violence around the country. It's been consistent all over the country, regardless of who's in those neighborhoods, if you will. Now, if you're in a place where there's low crime, a 30% increase won't include the type of violence that you're talking about, if you will, but a 30% increase consistently around the country, you know, just points to the unfortunate economic impact of the pandemic. And I highlight this just to get, again, I'm trying to get some context here. The conditions in which you will see those type of things increase is anywhere where human population is condensed. In other words, there's a lot of people kind of in one area and the economics go away. There will be an element of people who will not only enter the black market, but are willing to be violent in that market. And is very common, and it is a condition of humans. This country, unfortunately, loves to paint the context as if it is a racial issue, and the unfortunate reality is condensed population, lack of economics, there will be a small element, and unfortunately, something that we often lose sight of is crime happens in an exponential way. And so a small percentage of people who commit crimes will affect a lot of law-abiding citizens, which is absolutely the majority of the population and the majority of the black community. So I always like to give that context. Emil, I'll let you add anything that you heard. Again, just always appreciating, and she's a new caller. I haven't heard her call in before, so always appreciating all opinions brought to our show. But I'll let you jump in on what I just said as well.
So Portland represent, thank you, cousin, for calling in. We love having you on the show. And, you know, Portland's a microcosm of several places. It's got a very small black population. So what happens to black people in Portland is magnified because of the lens that black people are under in a place where there's few of us. But broader than that, we're talking about people who feel like the system they're in has failed them. We don't talk about this enough because the symptom of that failure is violence. Now, to your point about contextualizing the violence, the pandemic exacerbated problems that were already there. And so now we have to really look at what are the systemic problems that bring crime up in places where it shouldn't be higher than normal. When I say normal, that doesn't mean no crime. It means that for a given population, a subset is more violent for some reason, and we can look to systemic issues about those things. There is a systemic failure of black men in America, specifically when we look at the school-to-prison pipeline, when we look at how black men are treated in every institution that they're a part of, we recognize that there's the potential for systemic issues. And quite frankly, having gone to the Air Force Academy, having been in large institutions in corporate America, having been part of the United States Air Force, I can say unequivocally that we have systemic issues that are going fundamentally unaddressed that would stem some of these issues. Not all of them, But there's a pathology within black people that hasn't been addressed. We simply do not have the resources nor the will from this nation to address the issues that black people face. There's a lot of trauma that we still have to overcome that's generationally transported because we haven't dealt with it. And yes, we're trying to get more black men, especially into counseling, trying to get black men's mental health to be more of an issue amongst our own community. But the bottom line is, systemically, it goes unaddressed. And that is going to cause the kind of reaction we see.
Yep, and I would like to even just even nuance when we say the pathology. Some people haven't had that experience in a condensed area like you're pointing out in, you know, in the Portland area. Like, I grew up in a small town, so these are non-issues. And so I would offer growing up in that small town experience, while we have as a collective certain levels of trauma, I don't like to apply the pathology across the board, because, again, if a population is spread out, or if there's good economics, you don't see these issues. So I would like to highlight, not to even say pathologize black people, just going out again, another nuance. I actually got another person that wants to jump in, so we'll let them jump in as well. Area code 239, last 3330. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents on this morning's discussion. Two three nine, are you trying to go live or are you just listening?
Yes, I am. So, good morning. My name is Elijah Beauplan from Naples, Florida, and just an honor to hear both of you men speak. I just had a question for the both of you, just in regards to that last question, some of the points brought up from the previous caller. What are some of the ways, the resource and means you two have seen that would be able to help kind of not turn the tide per se, but definitely help close that gap for not only for African Americans here, but really in general, to, you know, have those means and resources to defend not only themselves, but their offspring and the generations that come after them.
Okay, let me just make sure I understand the last part of your context. So when you were referencing the last caller, are you referencing what's happening amongst, in a sense, some African-Americans in their own community? Because the last thing you said seemed like you were talking about maybe a defense outside of the community. So I just want to make sure I'm answering what you're asking. I'll make sure I'm answering what you're asking.
I would say both, if we're being honest.
Okay, that's fair. Okay, that's fair. I just wanted, both is fine. Both is fine. But thank you for the call, and we'll take a shot at Brother Ed. You haven't spoke, so I'll let you take a shot at answering this young brother's question. Thank you for calling in, Elijah.
Sure. Well, I've had the benefit of having lived in every social class that the United States has, beginning from the lower class and now in the upper class. And by kind of moving through those classes, I've learned some things about how societies work at those different levels that informs what I'm about to say. I also was born and raised in one of the most vicious municipalities in the United States during the 70s and the 80s, which was North Long Beach, West Long Beach, and Compton. So I was there when all the gangster activity that your favorite gangster rappers from the West Coast were rapping about, some of whom I know personally, where they were actually observing the things that led them to write the stories they told in their rhymes. So what I've observed is that those types of problems where you have black on black crime is stemming from something that I think is just a fundamental of human nature in Western civilization. We are all, at every level of society, from the lower class to the upper class, competing for the same three things, wealth, power, and prestige. However, when you are in the lower class environment, the competition is much more vicious. And the reason why is because you have less to lose. And what I mean by less to lose, you don't have assets to lose. You don't have a job to lose. You sometimes don't even have a family to lose. What you have to lose is your life, but you're willing to risk it in order to compete for more wealth, power, and prestige, and you're willing to risk it in deadly ways because you do perceive yourself as having more realistic ways of obtaining the wealth, power, and prestige you want. Most of the young men that I grew up around, they wanted more money all the time. They wanted more money. They wanted to be respected in the community more than they were all the time. And they wanted more power, which is the ability to influence others' activities. They wanted to be the shot callers, and they competed for it. But the difference between them and the men who compete for the same things in the upper class is that in the upper class, we have so much to lose. We don't want to lose the house. The brothers in the lower class don't have one. We don't want to lose our marriages. We don't want to lose our families. The brothers in the lower class oftentimes don't have one, or they abandon theirs. So it's a different contest, but for the same assets, wealth, power, prestige, and it gets more vicious the lower the classes get. The way I think you solve it is by doing everything that you can to help over the generations move lower class African-American households into the middle class, move middle class African-American households into the upper class. You slowly progress through these classes, and the higher the percentage of our African-Americans that get toward the middle and upper class, the lower this black-on-black crime will be. That's how I see it.
Now, I love it. We're up against the top of the hour. We'll go to a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Hey, where did you get that hat and t-shirt? I like that.
Oh, I got this at moneymotivation.com. It's fresh, right?
Yes, and I love the message on it, too. You are the hustle, huh?
That's what the shirt says. I am the hustle. They embody the entrepreneurial spirit, and what I like the most, it's more than a brand. It's a lifestyle for those who want to put in the work and expect to have the finer things in life. I also follow them on Instagram. Check this post out.
If you believe money is the root of all evil, you're using it wrong?
Or how about this one? Excuses made $0 an hour.
I like those. What's their IG?
At moneymotivation.co.
But do they have any ladies' gear?
Yes, you're going to love the clothing line they got for the ladies. Matter of fact, pull up their website, moneymotivation.com, and I'm going to get you a few things so we can both look like money.
Everywhere I go, go, and everywhere I be, I don't even talk, talk, they still know it's me. Cause I look like money, smell like money, talk like money, even walk like money.
Truth seekers, please understand, Mental Dialogue is much more than just a talk show. Each and every Saturday, we communicate with you for two reasons, to dialogue and connect. On the dialogue side, we cater to you intellectual outcasts who feel you have no place for honest discourse on race, sex, culture, and African-American business. On the connect side, we've created a community where you can connect with experts specifically in finance, whether personal or business, and mental health, whether it's trauma or to optimize performance, along with all the other skill sets from other MD community members. Our mission was to create a virtual nationwide neighborhood where African Americans learn to trade ideas, goods, and services through social media, meetup, and this podcast. To become a neighbor of the Mental Dialogue Community Club, please visit us at mentaldialogue.com. We are better with you than we are without you. We can be neighbors even though we don't live next to each other. Hashtag raise the culture.
We've enjoyed a full year outside of this pandemic, so it is time to double this membership. Thank you, I think the members that were at the live experience last night, for keeping us going throughout the pandemic, who most of them became a part because they could touch us at the coffee shops, at the barbershops where we started the Mental Dialogue Community Club. And we've expanded into this podcast, and now it's become a nationwide virtual neighborhood. But we need to add to membership. Go to mentaldialogue.com to keep intelligent radio on the air. This morning's discussion, my book, Reeducation of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture. I'm going to share another piece. This one is called Black Socrates Speaks on Race. As an African-American, don't ask me to forget my race. Instead, I'm telling you to respect my race. Once the majority understands this, we can finally progress. Although I was disturbed to see this article plastered with the headline, GOP Governor Bobby Jindal, racism wouldn't exist if minorities would just act like white people. I was equally disturbed by the accompanying commentary that suggested his intent was also progress. Trust me, I'm fully aware of the current sentiment in America to claim racism no longer exists, but we must work hard to keep perspective. This onus should not fall on us as black people, but failure to distinguish actual racism versus perceived racism hurts our cause as well. I think black people must own the fact we've cried wolf a few too many times, and now clear and evident cases of racism often go unrecognized. Many whites are so tired of being accused of being racist, they've become unaware of how their backlash against this sentiment is a deeper form of racism that significantly affects our country's ability to come together. People continue to suggest that groups shouldn't label themselves when in fact the failure to recognize and respect those labels in the past plays a significant role in today's progress or lack thereof. Professing that black and brown communities should just emulate the excellence of other communities is not that simple without recognizing the historical privileges still prevalent in our country. Just as Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, suggested, we must be careful not to confuse the success of a few with the success of the many. If neither side owns their part in this, minority victimization and white privilege, we are at serious risk of reversing the progress of the last 50 years. If we continue to dig in for the next 25 years, it will be pretty difficult to navigate race, gender, sexual orientation issues until today's babies finally get it right. I saw a PBS special last year that suggested the upcoming fight will be gray versus brown. The baby boomers coming of age and having to relinquish their property to the future browning of America, increasing minority populace. In the past, most have generally bought and sold their property to people who look like them. That won't be the case over the next 25 years. It's up to us whether this is a war of attrition or can we find a way to realize the American dream without this battle. Yes, I want to be judged by my character, but also I want others to recognize the way my heritage and culture affect my character. Just my 3 cents. All I ask is that you think. Emil, reaction.
So the end of what you said, I appreciate. I do want to be judged by my character, but to get to a character point, I have to be seen as human, and I'm not sure that I am every day. I'm not sure that my community is seen as a community of human beings every day. And the way we're treated, even in the modern era, does not necessarily lend itself a consistent reading that black people in America are treated as human beings. We have people today who are attacking our ability to tell our story about our presence in this country, formally from the government, saying it's not right nor fair for black people exclusively, but not exclusively, but specifically to say that they have a history that has been suppressed and needs to be told. That governor has convinced his legislature to pass a law that if it becomes a law, pass a bill that if it becomes a law, would limit organizations like our Greek organizations of fraternities and sororities, that would limit the kind of classes and majors that go in public school, university as well as high school and middle school. And it would cause untold disruption in how people perceive themselves in his state. That is a lack of humanity. So when I say this, I'm not saying it simply from a historical perspective. It's happening today. So now we have this conversation that I think we need to have, which is, what does it mean to be American? Because when someone says, if we just fold into another people's behavior pattern, that betrays what America has been for the past 250 years. This nation has been, whether we agree or not on the equal treatment of its citizens and people that are in it, it has been a melting pot of all these different people's contributions, African contributions, Native American contributions, Latino, Latinx contributions. It's not going to work to homogenize a people whose culture has been appropriated as the basis of popular music, as the basis of popular vernacular, as the basis of popular fashion. That's not going to work for this nation. We all know this. So that he said that is almost irrelevant, but what it does is it tells us that you are somehow not human enough until you act a certain way. But this nation has said, acting that certain way would rob us of a cultural resource we need to be who we say we are.
Ed, I'll ask you the first question on this one. It says, since race is a social construct, should African Americans be so concerned with the recognition of their history / heritage in America?
Yeah, that's a trick question, brother, and it's designed, I suspect, to be a trick question. The reason
Absolutely.
Why is because even though it is a social construct, that social construct influences every part of our lives. It permeates everything. Indeed, if you try to, you will struggle to find anything that is not a social construct. So one of the things that I do, in addition to listening to your show, is I listen to the Karen Hunter show that she does with Dr. Greg Carr. Dr. Greg Carr has been doing an excellent job over the last few years teaching everybody who tunes in an Africana Studies framework. And he makes clear every time he comes in and does his analyses that there are two frameworks that we always need to be mindful of. One is the social structure. That is their structure. What I mean by there are all the groups in the United States who are either anti-African American or neutral to African American in the sense that they don't care whether we do better or worse. So he talks about phenomena using that framework as well as what he calls the governance framework, which is our framework, how we see ourselves, how we relate to ourselves. In the social structure framework, it's very important for the powers, the powerful groups that want to continue to dominate us, to maintain a couple of processes. One, they have to have a very strong continuing propaganda arm of their social structure. That propaganda has to try to persuade as many people in the society that blacks are problematic, that blacks are inferior, that we don't study as hard, that we don't work as hard. These themes, these branding efforts have been going on for centuries, and they continue to today. And the reason why it's important for them to do it is because when you are trying to do the best you can to hold on to the big wealth, power, and prestige gaps that you've accumulated over centuries, you have to do something to convince otherwise reasonable people that those gaps should persist. And the way you do that is you just continue to smear, in my opinion, the African-American as a whole. You're seeing it happening now in Florida. I think that's the most intense spot. It's the most publicized spot. But all of this is everything, the attack on CRT, the attack on woke, whatever the hell they think woke means, the attack on diversity, equity, inclusion. It's all part of their way of diminishing the black brand in America. And it's helpful to them to do that because it enables them to continue to increase those wealth, power, and prestige gaps over time. They understand that these competitions are about wealth, power, and prestige, and they have been organized around competing aggressively to increase their lead for centuries. One of the books that I think would be a great companion discussion to this, brother, when people start digging in and having deep conversations based upon your book, Hanny Lopez's book, Dog Whistle Politics. The subtitle is How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. I recommend it often. He does an excellent job of explaining to everyone who is not quite sure about the game that's being played exactly what that game is, exactly why the politicians push this propaganda, exactly why they have to use these dog whistles. And there's another book by Eduardo Bonilla Silva called Racism Without Racists that would be an excellent companion to the discussion that could be sparked by this part of the question from your book, brother.
No, I love it. And again, sparking the dialogues, I hope people are able to contextualize how it becomes necessary so that you can see what's in front of you, like Emil so brilliantly said at the beginning of this show. We'll go to question number two. I'm actually up against the break. I'll get a quick answer to you from you, Emil, on this. Are some of the policy actions geared toward maintaining status quo privilege and power for whites, basically what Ed is speaking to right now, or will the demographics of this country eventually render white privilege null and void? Just a quick thought on that. We got to go to break. Emil.
Demographics alone will not change the power structure. You have Fortune 500 companies. You have Congress. You have major banks and insurance companies that control politics and economics. So in order for the browning of America to have an effect on the myth of white supremacy or systemic whiteness, as I often call it, you would have to see those brown folks who are in solidarity with one another matriculate into positions of economic, social, and governmental power and affect change at the policy level and enforce those policy changes. I don't see that happening simply by a change in mass demographics in this country.
Yeah, that's this is absolutely where the backlash of CRT is coming from, understanding the demographics are changing. And so in order to hold on to everything that Ed and Emil is talking about, that's the playbook that Ed is so brilliantly bringing up to the table. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Do you simply want your taxes done this tax season, or do you prefer to have your taxes completed by a professional on top of current and constantly changing tax codes? If so, look no further than S. Kynes Accounting and Tax Services, where each year, plenty of satisfied customers from around the country return for an efficient and professional tax experience. For small businesses, S. Kynes Accounting and Tax not only provides bookkeeping and accounting on a monthly, quarterly, and or yearly basis, but S. Kynes Accounting and Tax goes above and beyond to provide yearly tax strategies to increase the bottom line, profits. While no one likes when Uncle Sam or the IRS comes knocking, know you're in good hands with S. Kynes Accounting and Tax. Call them today at 770-947-3667. Again, that's 770-947-3667, or email them at advice@thetaxcoach.com.
LNG Technology Services, we are your industry leader in aircraft and heavy equipment repair services. In commercial business for over 15 years, LNG technicians have over 150 years of equipment-specific knowledge and are known industry-wide for returning worn-out, broken, and overused ground support equipment back to the user in working better than new conditions. For a service job done right at a value unparalleled in the industry, contact LNG Technology Services at 478-781-4860. Again, for a service job done right, that number is 478-781-4860. LNG Technologies is a Mental Dialogue Gold member and proud sponsor of the Mental Dialogue community. Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. This morning, special edition show, commentaries from my book, Reeducation of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture, out on Amazon.com. So definitely check that out. My special guest, a couple of my brothers, fortunate enough to get to meet in college, and we've been longtime friends ever since. But again, they are two of the smartest brothers I know, Brother Emil Bryan, as well as Attorney Edward Hopkins, or Ed as we officially call him. And so I'm going through the commentaries. I'm going to share another one. This one is called Black Socrates Speaks, Revolutionary Capitalist. This was written back in 2017. This system can and will kill you. If so, I plan to die standing on my own two feet. I'm strapping my mind first and my hips second. This is far from just gun talk, but instead using the same system that uses me to my own advantage. Lose the fallacy of leaving one system for another. Relocate by all means. I might. But that will still require you to navigate a man-made system of commerce, exchange of goods, services, and or money. Therefore, no matter the system, master it, not only to get money, but to leave a legacy for future generations. This approach does not guarantee life, but succeed and you will live and die standing up. Revolutionary Capitalist, hashtag just my 3 cents. All I ask is that you think. Ed, I would love to hear your reactions to that piece.
Brother, all I can say is something that a wiser man said many years ago, Claude McKay: if we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our cursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain, that even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow. What thou before us lies, the open grave?
Like men will face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. He said it better than I could, brother.
Oh, my God. Hey, can I shut the show off early? Can we just drop the mic right there? Show off. Emil, your thoughts on that amazing
Ed,
quote.
You want me to follow that, right? No, I'm not. I'm not going to follow that. My brother just went ahead and dropped a nuclear stanza from the great Claude McKay. No, thank you, sir. I will say this, as part of what we're going to have to reconcile in our nation, is capitalism the system that we're going to have to deal with? And if it's so, how do we make the most of it? Because it's a vicious system. It is often savagery wrapped up with makeup. It is something that has been extractive to the earth and extractive from our people. So if we're going to use capitalism as the system, since that's what we have in front of us, that's the tool in front of us, and we're not going to revolutionize to change it, then we have to approach capitalism with a lens of how can we reduce the harm that capitalism has wrought on ourselves and our planet? Because if we don't, then we're no better than the people who have already ruined us and the planet. So it's not just should we be revolutionary capitalists, but can we go from an extractive capitalist model where we're taking from people and create more of a productive capitalist model where we're adding to, reclaiming the environment, reclaiming the people who have been most abused by the system? If we go from extractive capitalism to productive capitalism, that in and of itself will be revolutionary.
Now, I respect that, and I'll highlight, and it's a slight challenge to what you're saying, is as I study more and more history, what we're saying is pretty much been evident at pretty much most of human history. I would say outside of maybe early humans where we, you know, for those who studied the type of history, understand that early humans were egalitarian to a degree, sparse society, sparse population on the earth, and, in the evolution of the brain, if you will. And so maybe outside of early humans, I would say definitely at the onset of the concept of land ownership and I can own something, which obviously changed the marketplace greatly, and the natures came at play. And so I'm kind of slowly walking through the onset of seeing a group that, as you mentioned, Emil, messed up capitalism. And I would like to go to this version where there's less of that. I would just ultimately highlight that there's, in my opinion, at least since the onset of land ownership, regardless of the system, when you say those that messed it up, that group will always exist based on human nature. And I would offer that the acceptance of it requires that we live and die by that amazing quote that Ed gave us. And I love creating hashtags, and I created the hashtag Revolutionary Capitalists. Need to highlight, I just dropped the Education of the Negro t-shirt with three bars. And so there will be a Revolutionary Capitalist t-shirt coming very soon as a part of the line. So I did want to throw that out. But I'll ask this question from the actual commentary, and I'll ask it of Ed. It says, do some people's disdain for capitalism hold them back in their own lives? I'll let you take a stab at that, Brother Ed.
Yeah, you have good reasons, especially if you studied Marx. Karl Marx, and you understand his philosophy, you have good reasons to question the viability of capitalism, but you don't have good reasons to question that capitalism is designed to make some people very wealthy and make everybody else go to work for them. So the thing is that as you kind of think through whether or not you need to participate in capitalism, here's the key decision point, I think. If you're going to stay in the United States of America, you better participate in capitalism. If you don't participate in capitalism here, you are going to put yourself, your family, and your bloodline at a further disadvantage, because that's the game we're playing here. And we're going to keep playing it here until this country no longer exists. So if you're going to live here, capitalism is your game too, and it doesn't matter if you love it or hate it. What matters is whether or not you want to put yourself at a disadvantage by not playing it as well as you can. That, to me, is a more important decision to make than whether or not you have philosophical problems with capitalism or whether or not you think you're contributing to the long-run demise of humanity. One of the things I oftentimes will recommend to brothers and sisters who have serious problems with what they perceive to be capitalistic systems is a book by one of the best scholars who's ever lived, Cedric J. Robinson. Professor Robinson was not the most well-liked African-American scholar when he was out there, but he made one book. He wrote one book that I think more of us should read. It's called Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. And what he does in the book, he doesn't go and praise Karl Marx, but what he does instead is he explains why Karl Marx cannot be used perfectly when you are doing it for a Black American group. You have to instead think about how the Black experience is different from the European experience, and then kind of reconstruct a new way of looking at economics based upon, in part, some of Marx's theories. But I recommend that anybody who really has deep, deep problems with capitalism read Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism before they make up their minds about whether or not they're going to play the game that we're playing in the United States.
Yeah, I probably should have warned y'all. I was gonna get a complete bibliography before these 2 hours was up today. but y'all are clearly hearing, if you were listening in the very beginning, when I say this is the most well-read brother I know in my entire life. Mill, I'll ask the second question on this commentary to you, and I actually like that it's coming to you. Is there a way to exploit capitalism and serve the Black community, in your opinion?
Absolutely. So I recently posted about my family's legacy business, Dean's Beauty Salon and Barbershop in Portland, Oregon. I will plug them. It's run by my cousin, Kim Brown. And one of the reasons why I'm plugging that business is because it was started as a business in the late 40s. The building that there was built by my grandfather and grandmother in 1956, and that building is still in existence. My cousin still runs that business. So you have nearly 70 years of continuous history in one place. That is a legacy for a family. That legacy has led to multiple degrees and houses being owned, property, and a great stabilizer for my family over several generations, right? Three generations. So yes, it is possible for capitalism to stabilize a family and create generational opportunity. And it can be done without harming the community. They charge fair prices over the years. They went through every era of Black hair care, from natural hair today to afros to jerry curls to you name it. So this possibility of building a business that doesn't hurt our community is very much possible, but it has to be done with the mindset of, what is the least harmful way for me to interact with my community that allows me to build my family's legacy and serve the community? And as long as we keep those two things in mind, we'll find that businesses are far less harmful and that they can be capitalist and they can serve our community at the same time.
Man, I love it. And I absolutely love what I typically call, because I big up Mental Dialogue everywhere I can, I call it a shameless plug. I absolutely love it. And it's especially afforded to you as a platinum level member, because you kept keep us on the air. But I think your time at the club, I think you could admit, has served you well as well. So not only are you being in support of this community club, but as the commercial at the top of the hour mentioned, we don't do this just to dialogue. It's to dialogue and connect. And so ultimately, we do business with each other. Myself and Ed are actually working on an opportunity, hopefully here in a couple of months, where this won't be just this dialogue as much as many of you are appreciating it, but the ultimate goal is to come together, go back and forth on these dialogues and connect to other members in the club. So go to mentaldialogue.com and learn how to become a member of what we're doing. For all the callers that are out there, if y'all are just enjoying the show, just fine. If you want to join us for this conversation, please press 1 and we'll let you get your 3 cents on this morning's discussion. I'm going to go to a quick cut that absolutely applies to what we just talked about. Again, I'm highlighting the commentary Revolutionary Capitalist, which is a hashtag that I personally created and wrote a piece about it. And I think this thought from one of my good friends, another brother that y'all both know, Mark Ranger, said on another show, particularly the show about revolutionary capitalism. I'll highlight that and go to break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
That even starts with clarity, meaning I believe the most important thing that you need to have to be successful or to lead people or to drive any movement is clarity. If you don't have clarity, you can't be aggressive. If somebody can't be aggressive in terms of moving something forward, you may get there eventually, but you're not actually going to be moving it at the speed that it needs to be moved, let alone the intensity that it needs to be moved and the preparation that it needs to be moved to actually make something happen. If people are unclear, they can't be aggressive, and we need aggressiveness. We need understanding. We need clarity on what we're actually trying to do, and I think that's what you're trying to point at. And then the other thing about capitalism that you mentioned was, to respond to that, we're not going to change capitalism in America. That is a useless effort to try to say we're going to change capitalism. It's not going to happen. I think that is putting your ladder against the wrong wall if you think the movement is to try to change capitalism. W.E.B. Du Bois said that capitalism was like having 3 ears of corn. You eat one, you sell one, and you save one for next year's harvest. Now, if you think about capitalism in that way, and we learn to adopt that philosophy, you can't tell me that we can't build something special. So when in Rome, do as the Romans do. We're not going to change capitalism, but we need to understand it and then begin to use it to our advantage to the point we were talking about earlier, but then how can we use it to develop more in our community, have the right ideas, and then execute on it appropriately.
Hey, are you a wine drinker?
A little bit here and there, but my wife definitely loves hers. Why you ask?
Man, you got to try this vegan wine by Sip and Share Wine. I ran across them at this event in Atlanta, and now I keep me a few bottles at the house. What flavor you like?
I like me a good red or maybe a nice dipping deal or something, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, try the sweet red first.
Okay, that's nice and smooth right there. Yeah, that's kind of sweet like I like it, you know what I'm talking about?
For sure, that's why I like that one as well. Hey, now try this Conjure Sipping Dance. This one was featured in Forbes magazine as a top 10 drink for the summer. See what you think.
Oh, okay, now that's fire right there. Where can I get a bottle of that?
Just go to sipandsharewines.com. They'll ship it right to your door. They black on, too.
Oh, yeah? Okay, you said what? Sipandsharewines.com, is that it?
Yep.
Bad.
Welcome back to the Mr. Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith. We're hosting our special edition, Re-Education of the Negro, Necessary Conversations on Race, Sex, and Culture, a book I just dropped on Amazon.com. Special guest Edward Hopkins, as well as Emil Bryan, are helping me hold down and get through this discussion, sharing these commentaries. This is not a book you just read through. I know people are prone to not read as much as they used to, so it is one that can create, hopefully, the dialogues you're hearing today. We actually have a caller that wants to jump in. Area code 720, last 3665. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents on this morning's discussion.
Hello?
Yes, you're live on the air. 665, you're live on the air. Give us your 3 cents this morning. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, no, this is Dominic calling from Denver. I just had a point just because I realized what, you know, Malcolm X was saying as far as how they use the stars, you know, like Alicia Keys is the new Billie Holiday, and how they use them to distract the propaganda of actually what's going on in America. And they put on TV, and then we obviously get lost in the looking like stars and not living like the ones who've worked their entire, you know, life in this era to live that. So how do we manage the propaganda, obviously, of television? And then what's happening, obviously, with these kids trying to be stars and robbing and bank heists and, you know, six-year-olds shooting up schools because they don't have Jordans or gifts that they deserve. So what is America's way of balancing that act? Because you're right, either you're on the other side of that or you're on the end of actually living what your purpose is. So how do we bring the youth to actually see that?
Right. I love that question. I'm actually going to tackle this one before, and then I'll let my guests jump in as well. We've done a show specifically of, I think it was questions to the effect of why so many youth want to be athletes or rappers or something like that. And so I love the question, and I'll just highlight, you use the key word propaganda. And so what happens is in order to fight propaganda, it starts with awareness. And so quite often, even within the community club, we're often helping people become aware of even allowing your children to have the phones at their will. And then the advertisers, the propaganda, it's always going to be, you're always going to be chasing that, because if you don't lose sight of how intentional you must be in protecting, really, your youth's minds from that. And so the reality is, when enough adults don't understand that, and I even said this last night at the event, not the fault of current parents in the standpoint of we never knew we would have hands and commercials in our hands every second. Like, that's not something, in a sense, that parents ultimately could prepare for, I say, but now we have the data. Science usually can only catch up once it does its studies, and we know that it's changing attention spans, and we know that advertisers are ruthless with the ability to advertise, with the use of psychology to push people, as you just mentioned, to want these items. And quite often, when you are, quote unquote, in the have-nots, you would define yourself by the things that you wear outside of you versus defining yourself based on who you actually are. So I hope this little soapbox that I'm going on now makes sense to any parent on how intentional they must be. I highly recommend you don't give your children access to phones, even though all their friends will have it as soon as most of them do. And to be extremely intentional that as you decide to give out your phone, that you are super intentional on about what your children can see and pass that down. I know of some families who actually do no screen access, and these are the most brilliant children I've ever spoken to. I'll let Brother Ed jump in and give his answer. Again, I kind of went on the soapbox just to say a lot of things that I hope somewhat answers your question. And it's obviously we're up against the machine of, as one of my friends says, Brother Hazik Ali, he says, the machine of the USA. He doesn't call it the United States of America. He calls it the United States of Advertising. Go ahead, Brother Ed.
Brother, let me just take a moment to pause, man, to tell you how grateful I am and all of us should be that you bring us together to have these conversations. It's difficult to have these kind of conversations in normal life. Without your platform, brother, a lot more of us would have more difficulty making it through our experience here in America. So thank you, brother. What we're doing here, man, every time I have these kind of conversations, please forgive me, man, but, you know, books start to pop into my head. Books.
No,
that
I love
read,
it. No, and, no, I don't. I'll keep adding to the bibliography, brother. Please keep adding.
And I'm telling you, when we're talking about this particular subject that the caller just kind of brought up, and he did eloquently explain, one book that I would recommend that everybody read is called Propaganda by Edward Bernays. That's spelled B-E-R-N-A-Y-S, Propaganda. He runs the game down. And you know what? The book was published about 100 years ago, and the game hasn't changed. So the thing is what I think the solution is, and this is a hard solution because we are already overburdened. There is something to be said for that old idiom that you got to work twice as hard. Some of us were raised to believe you got to work three times as hard to get the same amount as equally talented, equally industrious European-American peers. And there's a lot to it. But one of the other things that I think we need to start discussing more is the obligation for the black parent to become a professor. The black parent of each household needs to be a professor. They need to be lifelong learners, and they need to put themselves in a position to guide their children through a very complex African-American experience in the United States. And the only way to do that well is to continuously educate yourself so that you can improve the advice and wisdom you pass on to your children. That's another burden that we have to take on. Because the American system that we're in was not designed for our prosperity so much as it was for the European Americans' prosperity, we must take special care and make special types of plans for educating our children inside our homes, not in their schools, but inside our homes. And this is more than helping them with homework. This is teaching them about Frederick Douglass. To do that, you have to read it and learn about him yourself. This is teaching them about William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. To do that, you have to read and understand the man himself. This is teaching them about Toni Morrison, the greatest African-American writer who has ever lived and a graduate of Howard University. You have to know that stuff yourself to pass it on wisely to your children, and it's another burden that we have to take on in order to give our children the best chance to live decent lives here in the United States. So I believe that we have to take on that responsibility of becoming our own professors for our families.
No, I love it. I was highlighting this very thing when I used the 20 feet tall piece that we started the show with last night and literally said to a degree, some of, not as eloquently as you said it, to the group last night that came out to the, let me shout out Urban Grind, Black owned coffee shop that we spent 3 years in before the pandemic. She let us come back with the live experience, smartest event in the city every third Friday. But while we were in the shop, pretty much in the much shorter, quicker form, said the exact same thing. And at a minimum, exists that public school education, because at the end of the day, as you mentioned, the prosperity was not designed for us. And specifically, as we highlight, the fight to take certain things out of the school system. And so to your point, Ed, this obligation has existed, whether CRT, quote unquote, and it's a misnomer. They're misusing the word CRT. Matter of fact, I even hate how it's been politicized, so I'm not going to use that term because they're misusing it. But we're clearly seeing the attack on what should or should not be in history. But I would highlight Ed's point has been prevalent even before this moment, that the assistance that parents must include in order to navigate a child who did not choose to be here to navigate this American experience includes this additional burden. And if you are not a parent wanting to have children in the future, please include that in who you mate with, because your children deserve that. Within our community, we quite often love our children to death. Once they're here, the best way to do it is prepare for them to come here. And one of those includes accepting the edict that Brother Ed just brought to the table. I've been pushing it for years, and it is a balance of understanding why you must know history in the proper way. Because we learn it in the school system, it bores us, nobody wants to know history. All our people lazily point out, why do I want to know that stuff when all it taught us was that we were enslaved? And it's because you're only thinking the history you should learn is the little bit that they put in public school history anyway. No, you need to know these names that you're hearing Ed point out, all the names, the Michael just Baptiste, all the names that I shared with people last night, and they were kind of like, dang, we should know these people. And I said to those parents, I said, if that icebreaker, because again, I usually make it easy, but I told them when they walked in the coffee shop, I said, tonight's icebreaker is harder than usual. I'll tell you why later. And I surmised and told them the why. I said, I wanted you to feel just like that. I should know these names. And I said, if you feel like that, don't let your babies, don't let your nieces and nephews get to this same space of how you feel now. You are obligated to leave this coffee shop and make sure they, at a minimum, see themselves, because the schools will not show it to them. All right, I got back on the soapbox. My bad. Emil, your thoughts, King.
Yeah, no, I want it to be even more personal than that. What Ed talked about is beautiful, and I think that's absolutely apropos. But you should be able to walk down the street and point out Black inventions. You need to be able to say that the traffic light was created by a brother, that the GPS in your phone was enabled by a sister, that the moon landing was enabled by the human computers at NASA, the sisters and hidden figures. Like, we need to be able to make it very practical, very relevant, day-to-day, minute-by-minute, that we should be able to have our children understanding that they're surrounded by the brilliance of the Black mind. It's not just that they have to learn these names and the historical context of those names. I'm talking about day to day, minute by minute. You should be able to walk down the street. You should be able to open a book, or you should be able to watch a TV show. If you're playing games with your children, you should know that a Black man was the first man who created the cartridge for gaming systems. If you don't know those things, if you don't understand that we're surrounded by the brilliance of the black mind, then our children will never contextualize themselves as part of the society they're in. They won't see themselves adding to, because they won't know that their ancestors have added to, have been the trailblazers. So yeah, we gotta get the names of all these inventors. We gotta know the inventions themselves. We gotta know the practical part of it, so that we can walk our children through their history every day.
And let them know this. And let me cut you off real quick because we're on a break. But I'll say this: and let them know how Black America is. Let them know how Black America is. One of the giveaways last night was a book of scientists, inventors. I gave it away somebody in the room, you know what I mean, because of what you're talking about. But again, we are up against this last break. We will be back. I see some other callers out there. If you're a first-time caller, you do have to press 1 if you want to jump in on this morning's discussion. The number to get in is our last break. I may not be able to get to too many more, but I will accept one or two callers in the next segment. 646-787-1691. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Babe, where did you get that hat and t-shirt? I like that.
Oh, I got this at moneymotivation.com. It's fresh, right?
Yes, and I love the message on it too. You are the hustle, huh?
That's what the shirt says. I am the hustle. They embody the entrepreneurial spirit, and what I like the most, it's more than a brand. It's a lifestyle for those who want to put in the work and expect to have the finer things in life. I also follow them on Instagram. Check this post out.
If you believe money is the root of all evil, you're using it wrong?
Or how about this one? Excuses made $0 an hour.
I like those. What's their IG?
At moneymotivation.co.
But do they have any ladies' gear?
Yes, you're going to love the clothing line they got for the ladies. Matter of fact, pull up their website, moneymotivation.com, and I'm going to get you a few things so we can both look like money. Everywhere I go, go, and everywhere I be, I don't even talk, they still know it's me. Because I look like money, smell like money, talk like money, even walk like money. Moneymotivation.com, moneymotivation.com, the hottest streetwear brand in the land. Longtime sponsor, appreciate and salute to moneymotivation.com. We actually got another caller that wants to jump in. Area code 404, last 3741. Give us your name and give us your three, where you're calling from, and your 3 cents on this morning's question.
Hello?
741, you live on the air. Sounds like Brother James. I know that voice. I think I know that voice anywhere. Is that Brother James?
I didn't even think I was going to get on, man. Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with what the callers, speakers are saying. We hear a lot of people talk about the evils of capitalism, but very few times do they have an alternative. And I agree with what they were saying. Unless you have an alternative, if you want to live in the Western world, you have to learn to play the game. And it's not going to change in our lifetime. And even if it does change, it won't change probably without a bloody revolution, so to speak.
No, absolutely. Thank you for that. Any other thoughts, King? Thank you for jumping in this morning.
Thanks.
No, absolutely. Appreciate the support. All right, I'm going to go to another piece here. This is a short, very short piece, but I think it speaks to it again, Brother Ed. I have to thank you for just what you said about, you know, what we're doing here on this platform. And so I wanted to bring a piece. And I don't always bring this to the table for even as much as I try to explain this very unique and organic platform. And I know people outside looking in sometimes are trying to like, what's going on there? And it's like once they become a part of it, and maybe Emil, you could speak to this, you know, maybe before the end of the show. But once you become a part of it, then it all makes sense. But ultimately, the way we can figure this thing out is, it's through each other's experiences. And so once we understand the answers, the truth rarely lives on the edge, as I like to always say. The truth rarely lives on the edge. It's typically found in the middle. And so the dialogue, if we're opening to listening to even concepts that are different than our own, then there's great opportunity to get seeds that can progress us just from that conversation. And then sometimes good conversation knows you, who you should get next to and learn from. And so there's great opportunity with simply talking about the right stuff. Like there's always been this thing I grew up with where people always talked about, all we do is talk. And I'm, as I continue to do this work and get in this place, I always said, well, the big part of the issue is we're talking about the wrong thing, because no one can act right if they don't think right. And so there has to be some conversation before you can get to action. So I definitely don't want people stagnating over conversation. However, if we're talking about the wrong things, you can agree on something. If it's the wrong thing, it's not going to help you in 2023. And so with that said, the next piece is called Black Socrates Speaks, Why Mental Dialogue. I wrote this back in 2017. Black Socrates Speaks. As the founder of the Mental Dialogue Community Club, when I look at the landscape of America, I still see my community at the bottom of the proverbial totem pole, hence my lifelong dedication to improving the plight of African Americans as well as Africans throughout the African diaspora. I believe in the unity and brotherhood of all people. However, I think African Americans, due to our unique and brutal history in America, are generally blocked from that viewpoint and do not sit at the world table of brotherhood as equals. To remedy this, it will take a myriad of opinions, beliefs, and thoughts to raise our awareness to affect true change in our community. Therefore, at Mental Dialogue, we do not subscribe to any specific ideology, religious, or political belief. To drive action in the African American community, we must first overcome our distrust of one another psychologically. Hence, the name of our community club is Mental Dialogue. I think we do this by promoting critical thinking and learning to disagree without emotion. This will lead to practical solutions and improve trust. Malcolm X said it best, never confuse the method with the objective. And at Mental Dialogue, our guiding principle is if we bring smart and good people together, smart and good things will happen. Just my 3 cents. All I ask is that you think. Brother Ed, I'll start with your reaction to that piece.
Brother, you know, it's so important for us in a nation that is antagonistic toward our families. It's so important for us to really live that type of critical thinking life. And the reason why is because if you understand that the propaganda that's being pushed upon you through every media source that you can imagine, through Hollywood films, through your favorite television shows, through your news, indeed what they choose to report and what they choose not to report is all part of the propaganda. It's all part of the strategy. And you have to always be mindful that you are defending your mind against America at all times. If you're African American, you are playing defense. And it doesn't mean that you have to look at it as a burden. You can look at it as, instead as a challenge. Yes. But it's very important to live this life of the mind. You don't have to be a philosopher, but you certainly don't want to be someone who is not thinking critically, who is not reading, and is not having these kind of conversations, which we are blessed to be able to have regularly, thanks to you, my good brother. So those are my thoughts.
I appreciate that, and absolutely. Critical thinking, you will find your own answers. You know, self in the mill, we were mentioning this, and I know he's going to bring this up, so appropriate for the timing and apropos for as we come to, in a sense, a conclusion to this show. But lose sight of the Black Messiah. The answer is in your own critical thinking. And so in being what I consider myself a very good moderator, that's what my I think is one of my absolute strengths is because I remember the first 2 years of Mental Dialogue, if you were able to go look at pictures on social media, any pictures that we may have had, the first 2 years, I was never in the pictures because all my best friends know I hate pictures. And so when we would have group pictures in college, I would take the pictures, never would be in pictures. And every now and then some of my friends would snap a picture of me and they were like, oh, I got a picture of you, Smitty, as they so affectionately called me. But I highlight that the group kept saying, this is your group. You can't stay out of the picture. So in a sense, it forced me to get comfortable, if you will, with taking pictures and being in front of the camera. But I'm highlighting that nuance because I was so adamant from watching and studying history and seeing what happened to a Martin, what happened to a Malcolm, what happened to a Steve Biko, and seeing what happened to the movements that had prospered while they were here and what happened to those movements. sometimes being bastardized after the leader was there. So I say, what can I learn from this? And then as the world becomes more global, the idea of a black messiah, which was also part of J. Edgar Hoover's concern, as Emil Brent mentioned at the beginning of this show, was the rise of a black messiah, which was a real, true concern. And it got us so far. It got us to a stage. But in a global society, that is not necessarily the blueprint. So the critical thinking that we can invoke by being willing and humble enough, and I always use this example, this is one of my philosophies, that even if you are the preeminent expert on a subject in the world and you know 99% of the information of your subject and you're known and getting paid for your knowledge of that industry because you are the most knowledgeable, you will be shocked where the 1% comes from. And if you're not humble, you will miss it. That 1% may come from the person you least expected if you're not humble with your information. I highlight this dialogue to be aware that as you come into knowledge, because I see this mistake being made, I used to make this mistake, so I'm speaking from experience. So as you come into information and knowledge that you can therefore go use, it is commonplace to get excited with that information and try to share it to the people you care about the most and get frustrated when they don't fall lock and step. And the reality is, when you are exposed to be able to critically think about something, you can just sit the information out there and people will take the seed as they're ready, as they're able to critically think. If you're up against the propaganda, it can never critically think. It doesn't matter how much you drag someone to the, they're not going to drink. So stop dragging them to the water. Expose them to thinking for themselves. Protect your children's minds against the propaganda so that they can critically think and they will find their own answers. Emil, jump in, King. Emil, did I lose you? Brother Emil, you still there? All right, Ed, I'm going to let you jump in while we got a little, maybe some technical difficulties with Emil. Let me see if I can find him. Emil dropped and got back on.
Well, I sure do hope the brother comes back on because I want to hear how he was going about things.
Yeah, okay. I got it. Go ahead. We got you live, Emil. Sorry about that.
Okay, great. One of my favorite revolutionaries and activists and thinkers is Stephen Biko. And he said something that is so apropos for this conversation and for Middle Dialogue as an institution. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Once our minds have been usurped by the propaganda that Ed mentioned, we will do to ourselves what others had to use physical force to do. And we will do it willingly. And so the goal is to see what's right in front of us, to be so critical thinking that you question everything that was once assumed. The more we question reality, the more we question everything from the pavement up, the more we ask, why is this this way? The more likely we are to find the answers we need to liberate ourselves and our families. We cannot do this if our mind is usurped by the people who are trying to control us. Our prosperity in this nation isn't because we are oppressed. It was built with the intention that black people in America would be the engine of that prosperity. And that engine was fed by our enslavement. So it's not that the whole three-fifths compromise. When you say, I believe in the Constitution, read the Constitution and talk about the three-fifths compromise. Talk about why there's so important that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are seen as the restart to American democracy and how those three amendments were usurped by states and counties and cities all across this nation. Because it's right in front of us, but we're not able to see it because our minds have been usurped. So Mental Dialogue, for me personally, has been a liberation in that I get to have these conversations and I don't have to hold back intellectually and I don't have to explore with bated breath or with fear or caution that I'll be immediately rejected. Some of what I say is very revolutionary. Some of what I say is very mainstream. But what I am willing to say is that mental dialogue is a forum where I can say, I see what's right in front of me. Do y'all see it too? And then when they say yes or no, it allows me to continue to learn and grow and correct myself. I've learned much from mental dialogue because I have had the opportunity to share what I've known and then be corrected, be edified, and even be praised for some of the things that I see that others don't. So this is an opportunity in dialogue after dialogue to sharpen ourselves. As iron sharpens iron, as it says in the Bible. But it's not just sharpening. It's being able to walk with your eyes open all the time.
I thank both of you great brothers greatly. We are at the end of the show. MentalDialogue.com is how you become a member. Re-education of the Negro, necessary conversations on race, sex, and culture. Find it on Amazon. It is out now. All I ask is that you think.